It's Wednesday, October 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Coming up, who is responsible for a Malaysian Airlines crash in Ukraine? A report is out, fingers are pointed.
It's a growing region, it's a tremendous affluence here, and all of these things are all point to the potential for greater illegal imports of wildlife and exports.
Combating illegal ivory trade in the United States. Also ahead, how China fits into a trade deal it's not a part of. An outspoken Pakistani schoolgirl's story is now on the big screen. It's all on today's International Edition. The Russian state arms manufacturer of the missile system believed to be behind the downing of Malaysian Air Flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine last year says its own investigation into the crash contradicts findings from a Dutch probe into the tragedy. Speaking in Moscow, Almaz-Anti CEO Jan Novikov says evidence shows Flight MH17 was hit by one of Russia's Buk missile systems, as Western nations have alleged, but that the weapon was an older Soviet model, no longer used by the Russian military. The Almaz-Anti presentation came just hours before a Dutch safety board issued its long-anticipated report on the downing of Flight MH17. VOA's Luis Ramirez debriefs International Edition host Susan Yaki on details and mysteries from the Dutch findings.
The primary conclusion of this investigation is that the plane was brought down by a Russian-made Buk missile, or I should say a warhead from a Buk launcher. That was the main conclusion of this investigation. One of the things that was not clear and that has not been found by this investigation is who launched it. What we did hear from the Dutch safety board, the chairman said that while it is conclusive that it was a Russian-made surface-to-air missile, there was no light shed on whether it was rebels or Russian forces that actually launched it.
Will there be a criminal investigation to nail this down?
It's too early to say, Susan. At least that is what the Malaysian government is asking for. The Malaysia's prime minister issued a statement shortly after the report was made public, urging strong action be taken against those found responsible. For now, what the Dutch investigation says is that it clearly here, in their opinion, the Ukrainian government knew enough to have restricted airspace for commercial aircraft going in. They said the biggest question they had going into this investigation and throughout the investigation was why a commercial airliner was flying through this zone, even as fighting had been escalating for weeks. They said that the officials on the ground had information that the escalation of the fighting could endanger aircraft, including commercial aircraft. Yet there were scores of commercial flights going through that same exact area that day.
Then how did they explain it? Why were all these planes flying over this war zone?
That is one of the mysteries that this investigation, uncovered and is not simply has not resolved. It said that the information was there, yet no one drew a connection between the fighting and the risk to commercial airliners.
While the Dutch investigation does not seek to assign blame for the incident, Russia has chafed at suggestions the Russian-made rocket was fired from rebel-held territory. The United States, the government in Kiev, and other allies have repeatedly accused Russian military forces of fighting alongside rebels, a charge Moscow denies. Moscow insists Russian fighters in Ukraine are merely volunteers and have provided various explanations for the MH17 crash, all laying blame on authorities in Ukraine. We turn now to what social media users are tweeting about the latest finding. International Edition's social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 with details. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What is the U.S. response to this?
Well, very welcoming. The State Department at State DEPT on Twitter shared a video clip of its deputy spokesman, Mark Toner, leading Tuesday's briefing. It also tagged its spokesperson, John Kirby, in the same tweet and shared a statement. It wrote, "We welcome findings of Dutch Safety Board in final report on Malaysia Airlines flight, #MH17. And like you said earlier in the show, Jim, the finding shows Russian-made rocket was fired from areas controlled by anti-Moscow rebels.
And Russia immediately denied any involvement in the accident. Is that reflected in the Twitter world?
Oh, very much so. So Moscow is expressing doubts about the entire investigation itself, and the Paris-based news agency AFP tweeted this. #Breaking, Russia says serious doubts about the aim of Dutch MH17 probe.
What about from Russia's state-owned news outlets?
Well, same sentiment. So RT, which used to be Russia Today, also tweeted about the latest findings. But naturally, the tone is a bit more toned down from that of the Western media. It sent out this tweet earlier Tuesday. #MH17 down by outdated Buk missile fire from Kiev-controlled area. Quoting a defense system manufacturer, and RT is on Twitter at RT_COM. And, of course, China, Russia's buddy on the world stage, is also showing more cautious stance toward the findings. So the Chinese state-run news outlet Xinhua News Agency tweeted this. Some #MH17 passengers might have been conscious for 1 to 1.5 minutes before a crash. So it's tweeting about the findings, but not necessarily the part that involves Russia. Back to you, Jim.
Interesting. Well, thank you for being here today, G. She tweets for our VOA International Twitter account at VOA_IE. And of course, if you like, you can also follow her on her very own account. It is at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
#VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at #VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Companies are lining up to be a part of the pending Trans-Pacific Partnership. Which countries stand to benefit the most from this historic trade agreement? Well, to find out, we're joined by Alexis Christophorus from New York. Alexis, we do know that China is not a signatory to the trade deal.
On the surface, Jim, China appears a clear loser because it's not part of the 12-member bloc led by the U.S. and Japan. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is meant to deepen economic ties and lower or eliminate tariffs between those countries. But company executives and economists say that despite China's slowing growth, at least in the near term, it's well-armed against harm from TPP. That's thanks in part to its reliance on more domestic consumption. So far, demand at home hasn't quite kicked in to make up for sputtering exports, but there is evidence consumption is becoming a more important growth driver in China. Retail sales grew 10.5% in the first 8 months this year, compared with GDP growth of around 7%. And several industries are now looking for growth primarily at home, including the textile and heavy equipment firms. Further down the road, China could face major hurdles if it remains outside the pact. If implemented, the agreement could make it more difficult for higher-end Chinese industries to break into lucrative markets like the U.S. and will lift competitors like Vietnam and Malaysia, just as rising wages and other costs make manufacturing in China more expensive. Jim?
Alexis, I understand that China's car sales gained some momentum in September. What's the latest?
China's car market managed a mild recovery from a three-month decline as the stock market steadied in September. Sales of passenger cars were up 3.3% from a year earlier to 1.75 million vehicles. Industry watchers expect a recently announced tax break on small car purchases to boost sales in the coming months, but manufacturers and dealers are still under pressure from falling prices. Meantime, Ford will pour nearly $2 billion into smart cars for China, where its sales have been slipping amid industry-wide weakness. Ford is hoping the R&D spending push in China will help it develop smart car features specifically tailored to Chinese drivers. Potential features include allowing drivers to control more car systems through their smartphones and to use their mobile chat functions, especially during those notorious traffic jams. Jim?
Always in the driver's seat with the latest economic news, Alexis Christopher is from New York. Thanks, Alexis.
Thanks, Jim.
Commercial imports of elephant ivory have been banned by national laws and international treaty for decades. But in the United States, activists are pressing states to pass their own laws to deter the poaching of elephants and rhinos. Correspondent Tom Bonsi looks at efforts in the American West to protect endangered wildlife on the African savanna.
A quartet of special agents and wildlife inspectors from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service arrive at an air cargo warehouse near Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. They're armed not with guns, but with handbooks on African wildlife and power screwdrivers. The federal inspectors want to look inside several wooden crates.
These got a lot of stuff in it.
The manifests say the crates contain trophies from big game hunts in southern Africa.
So this is ivory.
In this case, says Supervisory Inspector John Goldman, it's okay because the tusk belongs to a warthog skull. That's not a protected species. Recent investigations of elephant and rhino poaching in Africa attribute the upsurge in trafficking to demand from China and neighboring Southeast Asian countries. The subject of wildlife trafficking came up when President Barack Obama met at the White House with Chinese President Xi Jinping late last month. A White House list of the bilateral agreements reached during that summit included a promise of action from China to match a previously announced U.S. crackdown on the ivory trade. Some observers say that sales in the United States do not materially contribute to the illegal ivory trade, but wildlife advocacy groups assert the U.S. has one of the biggest markets in the world for ivory, legal and illegal, and that ending demand at home is a key to stopping the slaughter of elephants abroad. And that's where John Goldman and his inspectors come in. The forests and savannas of Africa may seem a world away, but animal contraband does make it all the way to the Pacific Northwest. There are about 3 to 4 interceptions per year of elephant ivory jewelry or carvings or an improperly imported sport-hunted elephant trophy, this at the Seattle-Tacoma seaport and airport and along the nearby border with Canada.
Yeah, it's not very often that we're finding it, yeah.
But Goldman says there's ample reason to believe this is a legitimate problem.
We're arguably the fourth largest seaport, okay? It's a growing airport. It's a growing region. It's a tremendous affluence here. And all of these things are all point to the potential for greater illegal imports of wildlife and exports.
So it's an issue with federal laws to address it. And inspectors who don't find elephant or rhino products locally very often, why then do groups such as the Humane Society of the U.S., Wildlife Conservation Society, Natural Resources Defense Council, and others want new state laws against it? The Humane Society's Jennifer Hillman says it sends a message.
Having that much deeper level of enforcement at the state level is going to help overall with the trafficking that's happening intrastate.
And that's the direction New York, New Jersey, and California have gone, banning the sale of virtually all ivory within their states. The Oregon and Washington state legislatures considered similar measures during their sessions earlier this year, but those didn't pass. Opposition came from knife and gun enthusiasts and collectors like Stuart Halson. He argues it would be unfair to owners of legally acquired ivory-handled guns and knives or antiques.
The truth is that poaching in Africa cannot be stopped by a Washington state initiative. It wouldn't work and it would make legal antiques worthless.
At present, vintage African elephant ivory may be sold if the owner can document that it arrived in this country before 1990. Wildlife advocates are taking their campaign directly to voters with ballot initiatives in Washington State and Oregon. They make no bones about seeking a broad ban on ivory sales, no matter its provenance. The activists argue the legal ivory trade provides cover for sales of illegal trinkets and carvings. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Davis Guggenheim's documentary, He Named Me Malala, offers a probing look into the life of 18-year-old Malala Yousafzai, the Pakistani teenager who in 2012 was shot in the head by the Taliban for standing up for her rights to education in her hometown in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Guggenheim believes that prosperity, gender, and social equality around the world start with good schooling, especially in countries where women are second-class citizens. And that's why Malala Yousafzai's story was so important for him to tell. Guggenheim shows how, since then, Malala has become a symbol not as a victim of brutal violence, but as an advocate for girls' education throughout the world. VOA's Penelope Plue has more.
There's a moment when you have to choose whether to be silent or to stand up.
On October 9, 2012, Malala Yousafzai was shot in the head by the Taliban on her way home from school in Pakistan. Her crime? She believed in her right to education at a time when the Taliban was bombing schools in the Swat Valley. Her wounds were critical. But Malala Yousafzai survived stronger than ever.
They shot me on the left side of my head. They thought that the bullet would silence us. I am the same Malala.
To understand Malala's personality and inner power, Davis Guggenheim explores her family dynamics, especially her bond with her dad.
When she was very small, many friends used to come to our home. We used to talk about politics. We used to talk about the basic rights. And she used to sit with us.
When I was younger, I used to listen to him. Like, what is he saying, how he talks?
Davis Guggenheim says that Malala's life was almost prescribed from the moment her father, himself an activist, named her after a 19th century Afghan folk heroine.
She was inspired by the girl she was named after, the Malala of Mewand, that girl who spoke out for what she believed. And rallied the Afghan troops to defeat the British.
The film also shows that after Malala was shot, her father was devastated because he felt responsible for raising her with ideas that endangered her life. But Malala thinks otherwise.
My father only gave me the name Malala. He didn't make me Malala.
Still, the film raises the question, what formed Malala into the person she is today?
I chose this life.
Who would you have been if you were just an ordinary girl from the Swat Valley?
If I was an ordinary girl in Swat Valley, I'm still an ordinary girl. But if I had an ordinary father and an ordinary mother and a family, a conservative family, then I would have two children now.
After a slow and painful recovery, Malala made it her goal to rally for girls' education the world over. Guggenheim describes her as fearless.
Malala, you know, speaks to world leaders. We were in Nigeria when the girls had been kidnapped for a long period of time, and she sat she insisted to sit down with President Goodluck Jonathan and said, "What are you doing about these girls? It's your job to get them released." She met President Obama and asked him about drone strikes.
Nobel Peace Prize is to be awarded to Malala Yousafzai.
That fearlessness and her message brought her the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014.
She is something to teach the world, not just because she was a girl who was shot on the school bus, not just because of her advocacy work, but because she has a very, very deep soul. She's a very spiritual person, and I think she has a strong voice that speaks to a lot of people who are voiceless.
I tell my story not because it is unique. It is the story of many girls. We realize the importance of light when we see darkness, the importance of our voice when we are silenced. Let us pick up our books and our pens. They are our most powerful weapons.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
If you've happened to see the movie, we'd love to hear your comments. You can write to us via email. voaasia@voanews.com is our address, or you can join the conversation online through Twitter. You can follow us at @VOA_IE. You've been listening to International Edition. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You can always find us at voanews.com. We appreciate you joining us today. Come back again tomorrow. We hope you have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 9th anniversary of the murder of renowned Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. She was shot and killed in the elevator of her apartment building for exposing human rights abuses in Chechnya. In June 2014, a Moscow court convicted 5 men for the 2006 murder of Ms. Politkovskaya and sentenced them to between 12 and 20 years in prison. Despite these convictions and the 2012 conviction of Dmitry Polyuchenkov for organizing the murder, the identity of the person who ordered Politkovskaya's killing remains unknown. The United States urges the Russian government to bring to justice those who ordered this crime. According to the latest State Department human rights report, there was no progress in establishing accountability in a number of other high-profile killings of journalists, including the 2004 killing of Paul Klebnikov in Moscow and the 2009 killing of Natalia Estyemirova in Chechnya. Additional journalists murdered in recent years in the North Caucasus include Timur Kwachyev, Akhmednabi Akhmednabiev, and Kazbek Gakiyev. Russian journalists and bloggers who have uncovered various forms of government malfeasance continue to face harassment, either in the form of direct threats to their physical safety or threats to their security or livelihood, often through legal prosecution. By passing new repressive laws and selectively employing existing ones, the Russian government systematically harasses, discredits, prosecutes, imprisons, detains, and fines individuals and entities that engage in activities critical of the government. The Russian government has fined selected non-governmental institutions and stigmatized them by adding them to a list of registered foreign agents. Most recently, an appeals court upheld a $10,000 legal fine against Human Rights Center Memorial, one of Russia's best-known independent human rights groups. The arbitrary use and the abuse of the Russian legal system have created a climate of fear and self-censorship in Russia and put journalists and human rights defenders at risk. The United States supports the fundamental right of all Russians to free expression and assembly and calls on the Russian government to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.